My talk will be about how to construct Seek POVMs, and I will take the liberty of assuming that you've heard about Seek POVMs and you sort of know what they are. We're in a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Dimension is always equal to D, and we're looking for D squared unit vectors such that the mutual scalar products have the same absolute value. That's a problem, and you probably have heard that it's remarkably difficult to find such things. You're probably also aware, and I'm not going to enlarge on it, that Seek POVMs are desirable objects to have if you can find them. What you may have missed, if you let me just make a little propaganda for this paper by Feng et al. That came half a year ago. That's a very nice experimental realization of Seeks. But they're in dimension three, and our dimensions will be a lot higher. So what we expect for Seek POVMs is that in every dimension, they are orbits under a particular Heisenberg group, the Weyl-Heisenberg group, which figures in the first book ever on group theory and quantum mechanics by Weyl. If you wonder if this is necessary, the published evidence was very slim until recently. There's a paper by Samuel and Gedick that provides some evidence that this is really the only group that will work, with perhaps one exception. There is also a very curious conjecture due to Gerhard Sauner, which is that every Seek in every dimension always admits a unitary symmetry of order three. So there is a unitary operator that transforms a Seek into itself, and it has order three. This seems to be true. Andrew Scott has made extensive numerical searches for Weyl-Heisenberg-created Seeks up to dimension 67. They always have this symmetry. Together with Marcus Grassel, he has also extended these searches. So now Seek PVMs have been found numerically up to dimension 193, and they have made various observations about their solutions. So one observation is that if the dimension is of the form n squared plus 3, then you will always find a Seek with anti-unitary symmetry. And in my talk, I will exclusively talk about Seeks in dimension of this particular form having anti-unitary symmetry. These are the Seeks that I refer to as gold plate. And I'm going to tell you how to construct them, how to simply calculate them in dimensions that are significantly higher than what you can reach with numerical searches. Before I come to the actual topic of my talk, I should give a warning, which is that I will have to simply, in 45 minutes, I simply will have to slur over various details. So if you want the full details, you should consult these two references. Okay. And now we begin. So what does a Seek look like? Well, here I've taken what is known as a Seek fiducial. Let me remind you that the Weyl-Heisenberg group is defined as follows. It has three generators of order D, all of them. Omega belongs to the center of the group, and you can therefore represent it as a root of unity, primitive root of unity. And then there are two more operators, and you represent the first one. You decide to diagonalize one of them. So this is the operator Z here. And then the other operator X will be represented by a permutation, a shift of the basis vectors like that. That's important also because if you decide to use this representation of the group, then you have a preferred basis in your Hilbert space, namely the basis in which Z is diagonal. So it's meaningful to talk about the components of the vectors you're discussing. The Seek is supposed to be the D squared vectors obtained by acting on one of the vectors, which is then called the fiducial vector. And what you have here is an old solution. It was at the time, 2004, I think, the highest dimension in which an exact solution was known, produced by Marcus Grassel. and it doesn't look immediately attractive. I mean, there are little algebraic numbers there. Theta 2 has order degree 3 and so on. So it looks rather complicated. If you look at it closely, you'll see that the square root of 21 occurs all over the place. And what you should have done back in 2004 is to ask you why this happens. Ask yourself why this happens. It took some years and many more exact solutions obtained by Grubner basis, mostly by Marcus, before anyone noticed this fact. But finally, the Applebys, together with Gerhard Sauner, noticed that for every exact solution that was known at the time, the square root of d plus 1 times d minus 3 always figured prominently, where d is the dimension. That means that there's what's known as a real quadratic number field obtained by adding that square root to the rationals to form a quadratic number field is relevant to the problem. Moreover, a close analysis of the solutions showed that all the numbers that occur in the seek actually belong to a number field, which is an extension of such quadratic field with an abelian Galois group. That's called an abelian extension of the real quadratic field. And that's really one of the two key observations in the subject, because it tells you what kind of mathematics you should look for in order to make progress with constructing these things. Namely, you should look at number theory, algebraic number theory. And in retrospect, this is perhaps not so surprising, because there is another problem that you all know about. How do you construct a regular polygon in the plane? That's a number theoretical problem too. If you normalize things by placing the center at the origin and one of the vertices at 1, then the remaining vertices are roots of unity. And from the number theoretical point of view, this means that you have extended the rational field to the cyclotomic or circle dividing field that you get by adding the primitive root of unity into the mix of numbers. This has been generalized. So there is a general framework where you start with the base field, which will be the rational field for this gentleman here, and which is the real quadratic field, Q over square root of capital D, where capital D is D plus 1 times D minus 3, as a base field. And then you can classify all possible extensions of such a base field, which have an abelian Galois group. This was done 100 years ago or so. They will depend on what's called a modulus, or sometimes a conductor. I'm not going to go into the details here. And then in this way, you obtain what's known as a ray class field with the base field, in our case, this real quadratic field, and a modulus or a conductor, which turns out to be equal to D. So the second really important paper in the subject is this paper by Appleby, Flamea, McConnell, and Yard, where they claim, based on an examination of the solutions that were available, that in every dimension there exists a seek which lives in such a ray class field. It also, sort of say, there's, however, one thing hanging over this, which is that although mathematicians have classified these ray class fields, they don't really understand them. In fact, a good understanding of such ray class fields with real quadratic fields as base fields is one of Hilbert's problems from 1900. His intention was that the problem should be solved in the previous century, but it wasn't. There was one, of course, many people worked on it, and a particularly important development was 50 years ago when Harold Stark proposed a procedure to calculate what is in some sense the analog of the roots of unity in these number fields that we are interested in. And these analogs, the analog is not perfect, but it's pretty good. These analogs are now called Stark units. Their existence is conjectural, but sort of well established anyway. And The idea is that these start units will play an important role when you try to write down these Seek PVMs. So that's the background. Now we go back to Hilbert space and think a little bit more about symmetries for Seeks. The idea is that there's a group that permutes the elements of the Weyl-Heisenberg group among themselves. That's called the Clifford group. So here's a unitary belonging to the Clifford group. And the important part of the Clifford group for now is the outer automorphisms. So there is actually a symplectic group, or if you like, a special linear group, 2 over the integers modulo n. So what you do is that you take a 2x2 matrix with elements that are integers modulo n, and then you act on it on a little vector composed of these two indices. And this unitary here from the Clifford group will be a unitary representation of this group element in the symplectic group. So that's the automorphisms among which we hope to find the symmetries of the Seek. So there's one little detail here that I was thinking maybe I should slur over completely, but I didn't. We're doing arithmetic modulo n, and you'd expect that n should be equal to the dimension. This is so if the dimension is odd, but if the dimension is even, it's actually 2 times the dimension. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but it did figure yesterday in one of the talks. It is something you have to live with in even dimensions if you're interested in anything that has to do with these groups. Now it's important that because we use a fixed canonical representation of the Weyl-Heisenberg group, the representation of this symplectic group, the representation of these symplectic matrices as unitary operators is also fixed up to some phase factor. And I'm not going to give the complete details here, but an example is this symplectic matrix, which is actually you're forced to represent this when you do this as a usual Fourier matrix, whose entries, of course, are roots of unity. And this is true for all the representative unitaries. Their matrix elements are always roots of unity times an overall factor. There are some exceptional symplectic matrices that are represented simply by permutation matrices. These are the ones that are diagonal. Such a symplectic matrix will be represented by a permutation matrix. That's actually important. I should also mention a simplifying feature. If the dimension is composite, then the Weyl-Heisenberg's group splits as a direct product, and so does the symplectic group. That's very helpful because when you try to understand this group theory, you only have to bother about prime or perhaps prime power dimensions, and then you do the general composite case just by taking direct products. If you now recall that Sauner conjecture that every Seek has a symmetry of order 3, then it would clearly be convenient if that symmetry could be arranged to be represented by a permutation matrix. So that leads to the question whether diagonal symplectic matrices, integers, elements being integers modulo n, can be of order 3. This is true if the prime is equal to 1 mod 3, and not true otherwise, which suggests that perhaps it will be easier to discuss Seeks in dimensions whose prime decomposition only contains primes equal to 1 mod 3. That's going to be important, actually. And here's an interlude, which a little bit disrupts the talk. Going back to this magical equation here, that the real quadratic field is determined by the dimension by this formula, but you can turn this formula around and you say, let me choose a real quadratic field, so rationals extended by the square root of capital D, and you ask for which dimensions d, small d, is that relevant? It turns out that there's always an infinite number of solutions for the dimensions with the base field fixed. That means that the dimensions are organized into what's known as dimension towers. So if you fix capital D to be 2, then you get the sequence 7, 35, 1, et cetera, et cetera. If you fix the capital D to be 5, it had better be a square free number, then you get this sequence and so on and so forth. Sorry. And there is two remarks to be made about that. First, that the symmetry is not just order 3. It's order 3L in every known case. You can find a seek which is has a symmetry of order 3L, where L is a position in the tower. It's also important that if the first dimension in such a tower is of the form n squared plus 3, then every other dimension in that tower also has this form. I should say about these sequences that I've written down here that I've only written down those dimensions where seeks are known. And the ones that are underlined have been calculated using the algorithm I'm going to present. There are a couple of dimensions where the dimensions are in brackets. That means the seek is only known numerically. And it's interesting that you may care to notice that the dimension 2208, where the seek has a symmetry of order, its position is number 8, so the symmetry is of order 24. This is the largest dimension where anyone has been able to find the seek numerically. Higher dimensions simply cannot be looked for numerically. It takes too much time. Okay, that was the interlude. And I wish I was physically present because I would like to know whether you look, how you look at the moment, but I can't do that. Now, to return to our topic, which is to try to use this privilege, we sort of think we know what number field to use to construct seek PVMs in our dimensions. My dimension is always of the form n squared plus 3. And in these number fields, Harald Stark has produced distinguished numbers called Stark units. And the hope is that these Stark units can be used to construct the seek. This idea was first applied in a serious way by Gene Kopp. His approach is very different from the one I'm going to describe. He first constructs the overlap phases of the seek, and from that he constructs a seek, which means, for a reason I'll come to, that he cannot go very high in dimensions. What we have been focusing on is constructing the fiducial vector, and unlike Kopp, we are restricting ourselves to dimensions of the form n squared plus 3, where we expect to find seeks with anti-unitary symmetry. If you look at the prime decomposition of a dimension of that form, then there may be a single factor of 4 or not. There may be a single factor of 3 or not. All the other primes are equal to 1 mod 3. So that's a favorable situation where the Sauner symmetry can be represented by permutation symmetries. To make the whole story a bit easier to follow, I'm going to discuss the case when the dimension n squared plus 3 actually is a prime. That's conceptually the simplest case. And incidentally, there's a long-standing conjecture by Hardy and Littlewood, which says that this is in itself an infinite sequence. But after 100 years or so, that's still unproven, but everybody believes it. Now, because our dimension is a prime equal to 1 mod 3, we can arrange things so that our fiducial vector is left invariant by an order 3 symmetry, which is representing a diagonal symplectic matrix. In other words, the symmetry of this seek is given by a permutation matrix. And in particular, at least one of the vectors invariant, so the elements of that vector will simply be permuted by the symmetry. It will also be important to look at the centralizer of, we tend to call an order 3 operator a Sauner because, well, he came up with them. The centralizer of this Sauner operator, the elements in the symplectic group that commute with this matrix here, will also be a symmetric diagonal matrix, which means that also the centralizer will be represented by a permutation matrix, and that permutation matrix will cyclically permute the elements of the vector. Finally, the anti-unitary symmetry will also permute, will also commute with our symmetry. So it will leave our vector invariant, and the anti-unitary symmetry will simply be represented by complex conjugation. So this led Andrew Scott back in the days to say that he expected that in every dimension, in every odd dimension, I should say, in every odd dimension of the form n squared plus 3, there should exist a real Sieg fiducial vector. Of course, when you act on that, you use the roots of unity, so the final Sieg will certainly be complex, but the fiducial vector you should be able to write in real form. That's interesting, but it turns out to be not very useful for us. So in order to make use of Andrew's conjecture, we have to make use of an old result due to Einstein, coming on this page. We perform the following calculation. I wish this thing wasn't here, right? Remember that the Fourier matrix is part of the symplectic group, so you can act with on your real fiducial vector with the Fourier matrix, and you get another fiducial vector, so a unitarily equivalent Sieg. And according to Einstein, you can now perform the following calculation. You take the overlaps of the X operator, which is a permutation matrix, and you do the Fourier transform. And in this way, you actually get the Z overlap of the complex fiducial vector. And because this is diagonal, this is simply the Fourier transform of the power spectrum, or the Fourier transform of the sequence of absolute values squared of the components of this complex vector. Of course, Einstein didn't formulate this in terms of, the Weyl-Heisenberg group, because Heisenberg was still a very young man when Einstein did this. Instead, he was saying that the autocorrelation of a sequence of numbers is equal to the Fourier transform of its power spectrum. The next observation is due to was made in a master's thesis from the University of Waterloo, so next door to you. He noticed that the obvious fact, we invert this Fourier transformation, and if this real vector here is a Sieg vector, then this number here will be real. But because it's a Sieg vector, it also has to have absolute value 1 over square root of d plus 1. So that means if you stick that in, the sign has to be positive, by the way, otherwise it doesn't. Well, you can prove that the answer, the number has to be positive. That means that you can actually calculate under the assumption that the real fiducial vector exists. You prove in this way that the absolute values of the components of the Fourier transform vectors are equal, all of them except one. The zeroth component, which I put at the top, will have an exceptional value. All the other components have the same absolute values. This means that by choosing the normalizing factor suitably, you can write, you can show that Andrew Scott's conjecture then implies that there must exist a Sieg vector of this particular form, where the first component is the square root of this number that I call x0, and all the other components are phase factors. And because of the symmetry, the Sauna symmetry, there are only d minus 1 over 3 or over 3L distinct phase factors in there because they come in triplets. And moreover, the Clifford group via this symplectic matrix, which commutes with the Sauna, will act with permutations. So there will be a definite permutation action on these phase factors, permuting them among themselves. If you translate that into number theory, that means that we need a number field which is such that you have to have a cyclic Galois group which transforms a set of d minus 1 over 3L phase factors among themselves. So the degree of the relevant number field, if this construction is going to work, has to be d minus 1 over 3l, which is actually a rather small degree, other things being equal. So if you look at these ray class fields that were proposed by Appleby et al. In this paper that I mentioned, you take the base field to be this real quadratic field. Your dimension, of course, is n squared plus 3, which means that the formula d plus 1 times d minus 3 simplifies. So now d plus 1 is equal to some square, possibly times this capital D, which determines your base field. And D is a critical number that determines precisely which ray class field you're interested in. It's a conductor for the Seek field, if you like. You work out, given this equation, what D is, and then you notice that we were actually assuming now that D is a prime. But over the real quadratic field, this prime number is not a prime. It splits in two factors, as you can see, not a very difficult calculation. And that means, for the number theorists, that the ray class field with conductor D, which is supposed to contain the Seek, actually has a subfield where the conductor is one of these factors. And that subfield, the full field in which the Seek sits, has a degree, you can work it out, you ask Magma, is d minus 1 squared over 3. But the degree of this subfield is only d minus 1 over 3l, and it has a cyclic Galois group. That suggests that the Seek fiducial vector that we're looking for should be constructible using this subfield of the full Seek fields. When you act on that vector with the Clifford group, you bring in the roots of unity, and that will take you up to the full field. There is a little complication here, which is that there are two of these subfields. Conductor is delta or delta bar in my notation. One of these fields is real. The other one is the one we want, which contains complex numbers, if you like. But this means that we're focusing on this number field. We expect this number field to give us a Seek vector. And we expect somehow to construct the Seek vectors from start units in that subfield. Well, I'm not going to, incidentally, it would be better if my collaborators described how Stark actually proposes to calculate these units from zeta functions. It's an analytic function, and you tailor expand it at some particular point that will give you a numerically, digit by digit, the Stark units. The problem is that that calculation is done in this real subfield that we're not interested in as such, but we have to calculate the Stark units here. We have to calculate them to sufficient precision so that we can get the exact expression via the minimal polynomials. Once we have them, we make a little Galois transformation by turning the square root of capital D into its negative. And in this way, we move the Stark units as calculated using Stark's recipe to the phase factors. It turns out that the Stark units will be phase factors once they have been taken over to the field we're interested in. So this is, so to say, an outline of how we calculate these Stark units. I should say that this calculation is sort of non-trivial, for instance, for dimension 19603, which is the largest prime dimension we made. It takes 82 days CPU time. And this is by no means the hardest case we've done. The difficulties depend rather unevenly on the dimension. Sometimes it takes much longer. But we can do it in lots of cases. So we can calculate these Stark units, and we can see if these Stark units, which will necessarily be phase factors, are the phase factors we need in the Seek vector. Turns out that they're not quite. Turns out that we have to take a square root of the Stark units. That's not an entirely unnatural thing to do, because Stark's formula, where everything is real, means that the Stark units are positive in their real incarnation, which sort of naturally leads to the idea, let's calculate the square roots. And it turns out that the seek vector that we want, the seek fiducial vector that we are constructing, is constructed then finally in the following way. There's some normalizing factor n. At the top, you put the square root of this number x0 that I told you. And then you place the square root of a complex dark unit in this position. And you act on it with the cyclic Galois group. And that will give you the seek vector. That's the idea. And what I'm describing, admittedly somewhat superficially, is basically an algorithm. There's an algorithm for doing this that will produce such a vector. And now you can ask, why should this be a seek vector? That's a good question, and I'll come back to it. For the moment, well, it is. And I should make a couple of comments first before I go on with the text. So if the dimension is composite, I described that it's the calculation for prime dimensions. If the dimension is composite, the story is messier, but it's basically the same story. If the dimension is even, there is a seeming obstacle, because if the dimension has a factor of 4 in it, remember that the only even dimensions that have the form n squared plus 3 here are those which have a single factor of 4 in them. But if the dimension has a factor of 4, then there is no order 3 operator in the representation I described, which is a permutation matrix. And that would seem to mean that it doesn't work at all. But it actually can be done by means of a trick, and I'll describe that briefly on the next slide. Before doing that, let me just say that by now we've done this calculation following this algorithm in altogether 72 cases. Every case up to n is 53, and it's always a seek vector, the thing we get. It always works. One reason for doing the calculation in that many cases is that we really want to make sure that among the composite dimensions or so, that doesn't lurk a surprise, which forces us to modify the algorithm. Actually, we have found two surprises in composite dimensions, and we have been able to modify the algorithm so that it covers those as well. So everything is fine. But of course, you can be nervous. What happens if you do not only 72, but 100 cases? Maybe there will be some additional surprise in some case. We don't know that. Okay, so even dimensions, I'm not going to say much about them, but let me just say that there does exist a trick based on an obscure paper that people didn't take notice of from quite some years ago. We don't use a standard representation of the Weyl-Heisenberg group in the dimension 4 factor. Instead of diagonalize the Z operator, we diagonalize, these three operators, which forms a maximal commuting set in the dimension 4 factor. And when you do that, it turns out that the whole Clifford group, not just the order 3 operator, but the whole Clifford group will then be represented by monomial matrices. And it's easy to arrange for the order 3 operators to be given by pure permutation matrices. And we're on track again, and we can do everything. So this was sort of a forgotten paper, but fortunately, some of us were co-authors of this paper, so we remembered it. That's actually a very nice paper, feature of even dimensions here. Even dimensions, which is unusual, are actually simpler than odd dimensions in some regards, because particularly if the dimension is equal to 4 times a prime number, the prime number being 1 mod 3, of course, then, well, the degree will have a factor p minus 1 in it, and p minus 1 actually splits like this. And since the complications in the actual calculations depend not only on the degree of the number field, but on how they split into prime numbers, a big prime factor in p minus 1 will cause problems. But if you look at dimensions of the form 4p, then the biggest prime factor will grow only like the square root of the dimension, rather than growing like the dimension as it does in the prime case. That means that the case when the dimension is 4p is probably the simplest case if you want to do explicit calculations. So now to return to the really bad question or the really serious question, why is this procedure that I've described to you possible? Why does it produce a seek POBM? And the short answer is that I don't have the faintest idea why it does that. But of course, once we have constructed such a vector, we can check if it's a seek POBM. We can calculate the overlaps. There's also a clever way of checking that it's a seek. But yeah, let me briefly describe that. So you take these numbers here, which should be equal to 1 over d plus 1, if it's a seek. These are the modulus squared, and then you Fourier transform that. And after a little calculation, you find that this expression depends only on the components of the vectors. And in our case, where there's an anti-unitary symmetry, you don't even have to have any complex conjugates in there. You just use the anti-unitary symmetry. So this is some sort of algebraic variety once you put this equal to this thing here. So these d squared quantities being equal to that is actually equivalent to the seek conditions. This is an old observation due to Appleby, Dang, and Fuchs. And an advantage in our situation where the dimension is, where the symmetries are represented by permutations, is that you can easily build in the symmetries. You can even build in the Galois symmetries very easily in this calculation, which means that you don't have to calculate all the d squared gi case. You only have to calculate the subset. I think roughly 1/4 of the dimension is the number of gi case you actually have to calculate. So that means that you can, since these objects here depend only on the components of the vector, that means that the calculation is now, the checking of the seek condition is now completely free of the roots of unity, which means that the checking is done in the small number field and not in the full seek field, which I find extremely interesting, actually. It nevertheless turns out that because the Galois group is now much smaller, I mean, the number field is smaller, but so is the Galois group. So the number of checks you have to do is actually still larger than the number of checks you have to do if you do look directly at the overlaps. So eventually it turns out that the straightforward approach of actually simply calculating overlaps wins. So the largest dimension where we were able to actually do the exact check is 5779, where it was actually possible to check the overlaps in 6 days, whereas the calculation I just described to you was estimated to take 3 months. In the higher dimensions, I have to admit, we haven't done the exact calculation. We've simply done the numerics with 100,000 digits, and it works. That means that we're sure, modulo that something goes wrong with 100,000 first digit, we're sure that the vectors we've constructed are exact seek vectors in 72 different dimensions on the form n squared plus 3. But we still don't know why this is the case, and that's wide open. What's hanging in the background here is that in order to prove that there are seek vectors, maybe we have to prove the Stark conjectures. Remember that Stark's construction of his units was in itself based on conjectures, which have been open for 50 years. So it may be a tall order to prove that our construction works in arbitrary dimensions. The first approach that occurs to you is that when you sit down to check the seek conditions, what we're actually dealing with is identities for Stark units. So maybe it's a little bit like, Gaussian sums for roots of unity. There are lots of results that give identities between roots of unity, and maybe one can prove identities for Stark units that will enable us to do the full proof that our construction always works. That's one possibility. We haven't gotten anywhere with this, but it's certainly a possibility. We may need a completely different perspective on the number theory. And this is supposed to be forthcoming. There's a paper that has been announced for quite some time now by Appleby, Flamija, Kopp, and Ladarius, which is also offers an algorithm for calculating seeks, but this time in arbitrary dimensions. it's not as computationally effective as the one we have, but it works in, it's supposed to work in arbitrary dimensions. They have a very different perspective on things. So I'm hoping that when this paper finally appears, that we will be able to, you know, get new ideas from it and maybe do something with them. It's also possible that the ideas we have with from number theory simply aren't enough. There may be, it may be that some completely new idea is needed, which is maybe not even a number theory idea, something more geometric. But I have no idea what that idea should be. So at the moment, the situation is this, that we have an algorithm, and it's really an algorithm, that allows us to calculate seeks in dimensions of the form n squared plus 3. We have no proof that it always works, but it does work in 72 cases, going up to some five-digit dimensions. So it looks plausible that we're on the right track. And that's all I have to say, I suppose. Not quite sure what you want me to do now, but I will come back to this slide if you want to have the more details. It's in these papers. Thanks. I did finish.
Thank you very much, Ingemar. We have about time for maybe one question, if there's a question. Was that? Hold on. Not working? Okay, so thank you, Ingemar. We have time for maybe a question. If there's one from here. Yeah, I have a question. So these n squared plus three dimensions, you showed at the beginning some prime factorization, but then I think you said later that, like, for example, four can appear arbitrarily many times.
No, that's a single factor of four. Let's see. The prime decomposition is as follows. It's a product of odd primes. All of them are equal to 1 mod 3. There may be a single factor of 3, so the exponents here are actually are either 0 or 1.
I see.
If it's even, it's divisible by 4, but not by 8.
I see.
If it's divisible by 3, it's not divisible by 9.
Gotcha.
And that's a little tricky argument. It helps to have number theory collaborators who can tell you that this is obvious, because it isn't obvious to me, but when it's not particularly difficult once someone tells you how to do it.
Also, a few slides later, you had something about, there was something that ran for a long time, but then you said with Galois symmetries, it ran in a few days.
Sorry?
I think it's one of your last slides. You had something that ran for like a very long time. And then you said
82 days.
Maybe keep going. But towards the
Well, calculating the Stark units for this dimension took 82 days, which is comparatively modest compared to some of the harder dimensions.
You had another longer computation or a long computation time towards the end also that you compared to.
They're checking. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So are you saying this is the same dimension 5779 that you check using the Galois overlaps?
Yeah, either you check them using what I think is this lovely idea due to Appleby, Dang, and Fuchs. We didn't actually do that calculation, but it should take about 3 months. Sorry, but it turned out because of the larger Galois group acting in the full field, that it's actually better to calculate the overlaps. And in that case, the calculation took only 6 days.
Gotcha.
And incidentally, what takes time is not what you expect. The problem is not calculating the overlaps. What takes time is once you have the overlaps to multiply it with its complex conjugate to make sure that is equal to 1, right? Or whatever it's equal to, 1 over d plus 1. So multiplying these two numbers together takes most of these 6 days. Mm-hmm. 6 days. Similarly, when we check numerically, the actual calculation to check numerically doesn't take all that long. I should say that in these very high dimensions, the calculations are not done by me, they're done by Marcus Grassel. But anyway, he tells me that what takes time is not the numerical calculation. What takes a lot of time is to convert our exact fiducial into a numerical fiducial. That takes time. Mm-hmm. And after that, the calculation is quick.
Yeah. I think often computing embeddings of number fields can be like very expensive at high degrees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any questions on, oh, Robert has a question.
Expert question is ours from a distance, but you spoke about dimensions of type n squared plus 3. Do you think that the ideas that you develop for this case will carry over to other types of dimensions?
Let me go back to my last slide. Not well, partially. What we are relying on is a trick. We're calculating the fiducial vector, and we are arranging for the fiducial vector to decouple from the cyclotomic field, so to say. This can be done in some other dimensions, but it cannot be done in general. It will not work, for instance, in dimensions that are prime equal to 2 mod 3. Then there is no such simplification of the fiducial vector.
Okay, but
as I was saying, there's another approach where they calculate Seeks in arbitrary dimensions, but then they deal with a full Seek field and they cannot go as high as we do. Look, this paper by these people hasn't appeared yet. I'm very much hoping that once it has appeared and once I can begin to learn the details, maybe we can, you know, combine the ideas in some way, but we'll see. Short answer, don't know.
Thank you.
Okay, I think it's time for a break, so let's thank Ingemar again.